Good afternoon. I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect, it is 1:34 p.m. on Wednesday, March 9th, 2022. Present today are Representative LeBon, Vice Chair Ortiz, Co-Chair Foster, Representative Rasmussen, Representative Josephson, Representative Wohl, Representative Johnson. Online we have Representative Thompson, and in the room we have Representative Hannon with us today. Thank you for being here. I'm Co-Chair Merrick. This afternoon, we will consider three pieces of legislation: House Bill 110, Age for Nicotine E-Cigarette Tax E-Cigarette, HB 104, Motor Fuel Tax Vehicle Registration Fee, and SB 33, Seafood Product Development Tax Credit. So first up, we have House Bill 110, Age for Nicotine, by Representative Hannon. Welcome back. If you could come up to the table. We last heard this bill on May 7th, 2021. And amendments were due to my office originally May 11th, and then again at 1 p.m. yesterday. We have 11 amendments. And with that, would you like an opening statement, Representative?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Yes, Representative Hannon, House District 33, which you are currently sitting in. To reprise and remind you, House Bill 110 would add into our current existing taxation structure on tobacco under other tobacco products, vape cigarettes. The last time that Alaska addressed tobacco taxes, nicotine taxes, vaping really wasn't a thing over 15 years ago. And because our statutes specify cigarettes and then delineates other tobacco products listing snuff, chew, etc., because vaping didn't exist, it's not listed, therefore it's not taxed. This bill would institute the current taxation structure that exists onto vaped cigarette products, e-cigs, vape, etc. It would also change the smoking age to 21 in Alaska in compliance with a federal law that is in a place. That law was changed in 2019, and states have till December 2022 to come into compliance or risk their tobacco settlement revenues up to 10% of those for not being in compliance with federal tobacco law. I believe that young people are more accepting of e-cigarettes as an entryway into being addicted to nicotine, and I think tobacco taxes discourage them from doing it, and I think that we should be taxing it. So with that, you've got a lot of work before you.
Great, thank you. Anything from the committee before we entertain amendments? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Representative Hannon, good to see you again and welcome back. And I just sort of want to get on the record and stay out front. I support your efforts for the tax, and I'm looking forward to the hearty discussion. Obviously, as you know, with other bills, there's other issues in the bill that we may push against that I know you had nothing to do with, so please don't take it personally. that being said, let's proceed.
Well, that's a great sign. Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Ready to rumble.
I apologize. Through the chair, Representative Hannon. The other body, and I know we can't talk about the other body on the floor generally, but the other body has concluded so far that the delivery instrument, the metal and plastic, commonly called the device, I guess should be taxed as well. It's in their bill. Do you take a position on that as a policy matter?
Well, if, through the chair, as a new technology, one of the things that we risk is crafting a definition that can be walked around or worked around. And my staff and I, when we requested the bill, intended to tax what are considered integrated devices. So there are some devices that are, in essence, proprietary. You need to own my device to be able to smoke my cartridges. Some of the earliest types of those were available only through internet sales, and you had to buy your cartridges from that same company. Now, of course, an industry has developed where there's a whole device section industry, and pod separate from that. Maybe the parts are interchangeable, maybe they're not. The definition that I've used in my version of the bill, the House version currently, doesn't incorporate as broadly all the device options that there are in the industry, but does ones that are integrated. So if you have to have that pod with this device, then it is incorporated in the definition I use. The Senate has, excuse me, the other body is using a definition that is broader in an attempt to capture all the devices that are on the market, whether they are proprietary to my pod being used in that device.
Thank you.
Thank you. I see nothing further. With that, we will move to amendments. We have amendment number one by Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson, is there a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move amendment number one.
I will object for the purpose of discussion. Go ahead, Representative Thompson.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. In the room with me, or there, not with me, I'm in my apartment, but is my staff, Tom Wright, to answer any technical questions that might come up. Amendment number one addresses the smoking age of 21. Alaskans are considered to be adults at 18, and at age 18, you can be drafted into the Army, be issued a weapon, be sent to war, and be killed. And I feel like that we're overstepping, even the federal government is overstepping the right of a person to decide what they want to do. For many, many, many years, social issues like the smoking age were all left up to the states. And I feel like we're overstepping this a bit. You do have a legal memo in your packet that speaks about the fact that the federal government is making it a law for 21 years of age. And we could possibly lose federal funding if we don't comply with their exact same age that they have. That isn't true yet, but if this does become a reality that it would affect our ability to receive grants, then we definitely would need to come back and change this. But I feel at this time that we're infringing on an adult's right to do things, and that's why we are bringing amendment number one to the House committee.
Great. Thank you, Representative Thompson. We have questions from Representatives Rasmussen and then Josephson and then Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the chair. Just in reading through your memo, it looks like we would be at risk starting December 21st, 2022. Do you know how much funding is at risk if we get through this session without changing anything? Obviously, the next legislative session, we pass this deadline, and I'm not sure that we would have the votes to call ourselves back into session. So just curious what we may be on the hook for financially.
I'm not aware right now of what it would be or if they actually would institute that requirement. I don't have anything more on that. I don't know if my staff, Tom Wright, has or not.
I can speak to that. Stephanie Andrews, staff to Representative Hannon, Representative Rasmussen through the chair. Legislative Finance has told our office that it is has been for the past few years about $30 million that we put up to risk of federal substance use disorder grants, and that we put up to risk 10% of that for if we do not comply with the federal T21 law. So therefore, we're putting at risk approximately $3 million in federal grants by not complying with federal law.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Through the chair, I tend to agree with the sponsor that we allow people to enlist at 18, and I feel like as much as we can maintain our state's rights, we should try to do so. So I do believe I'll be supporting this amendment.
Thank you, Representative Rasmussen. Representative Josephson. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess this amendment brings out my libertarian streak a little bit, and I do agree with the sponsor that if 18, you're an adult, which is what we all recognize in this country, you're an adult, you can vote, as the sponsor said, you can be drafted, you can go to war, you can be issued a gun, you can be basically licensed to kill. You can also buy a gun. You can buy an AR-15 at 18. So we're trusting people to buy heavy weaponry at 18. If you're committed of a crime, you go to adult jail. You don't go to under 21 jail. You go to the adult jail, prison, which is serious. You can adopt a child at 18. You can rent a car. You can move out of the house. You can buy a house. You can do all kinds of things at 18. And I don't support smoking. It's an unhealthy habit. Have I done it in my life? Yeah, I have. And I've quit. But I think 18 should mean something. And most countries don't, you know, I don't want to talk about what other countries do, but most of them don't have a 21 tobacco age. They don't have a 21 drinking age, too. Most countries in the world have an 18 drinking age as well, which the federal government also raised to 21 and told states if they don't comply, they'll lose highway funding, and they're doing the same thing here. So, you know, I understand the power of the purse, and we are susceptible to it, but I believe that if you're an adult at 18 and you can vote and get married and buy guns and go to adult prison, you should be able to smoke a cigarette at your wedding.
Thank you, Representative Josephson, and then Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I only wanted to speak because I can tell we're in discussion more than questions. I wish we had a gun bill before us. That would make me very happy, but we don't have a gun bill before us. And I don't subscribe as much to, I think it's called dual federalism, as the standard model, which is the supremacy clause and an understanding that the federal government supreme. If we challenge the law, we challenge the law. But certainly when it comes to states' rights, the right to be permissible, more permissible as regards tobacco, isn't something I want to jealously guard. So I oppose the amendment.
Thank you. Representative LeBond.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do support the amendment, but I have a question that maybe the maker of the bill, Representative Hanna, could answer. We've heard about the military connection. You can join the military, go off and fight a war at 18. Does the military have a policy regarding using tobacco products under the age of 21?
Yes, and the policy is they cannot.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions? Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And just on that last question about the military, if the military is stationed in a country with a tobacco age lower than 21, and are soldiers allowed to smoke in, you know, on the streets of Germany or something like that?
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, when we asked the Department of Defense to make sure we were crafting a bill that complied with federal law, the response was the federal smoking age of 21 or tobacco use age of 21 was in place in all U.S. military posts and locations. So now, on the streets of Bangkok, if you're not on a military post, is the U.S. MP ticketing you? That was not addressed. And I feel compelled to make sure, because you referenced it being 18, there's a couple others saying 18. The amendment as proposed does not change the age to 18, it changes it to 19.
Thank you. Let the record reflect we're joined by Representative Edgman at 1:48 p.m. Is there anything? Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the chair. Could the maker of the amendment speak to the rationale for the age of 19 instead of 18?
No, I feel like this is Representative Thompson again, through the co-chair. Representative Rasmussen, 19 is what basically it's been, and it seemed to have been accepted, but I would not argue about the 18 at all. If you want to know back in the history, back in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a precedent set at one time that we used to have the drinking age at 19 years of age in Alaska. Federal government came out and said, you're not going to get any highway dollars if you don't move it to 21. So we did. But at the same time, we gave a exception. If you were 19 years of age when that passed to move to 21, you were grandfathered in. So bartenders had to look at your license to see if you were 20 years old, you could still have a beer or whatever happened in those times. So it's an interesting conundrum that we're at, looking at 18, you can be not just joined, you could be drafted into the military and forced to do these things. And so you're an adult in everybody's mind, except in the smoking age. So I don't have anything else on that. I don't know if we lost any money when we let people drink before they turned 21 through that period of time or not.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the Chair. So just for clarification, this amendment restores the current smoking age of 19 in state statute. It just brings it back to where it currently stands.
Correct.
Thank you. Representative Josephson.
Well, just a comment for the body. I'm remembering from teaching constitutional law that the case relative to alcohol was called Dole versus South Dakota, or really South Dakota versus Dole. She was the wife of the late Bob Dole, who died a few months ago. And the issue was the spending clause of the United States Constitution. And the spending clause, even conservative justices say that's really the government's bailiwick. If they want to not spend on something and require adherence to a policy, or they won't give X dollars, they're going to win that a lot. And they did in South Dakota versus Dole. So what's at issue here is we're going to have 19, 20-year-olds smoking, and we're not going to have $3 million, even though it's the law. And I guess the federal government could, they're not likely to do it, they could try to enforce the federal law.
Thank you. Anything further from the committee? I will remove my objection. Is there further objection to Amendment 1?
Yes.
With that, will Madam Secretary, will you please call the roll?
Representative Rasmussen.
Yes.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Wolf.
Yes.
Representative Edmond.
No.
Representative Johnson. Representative Josephson.
No.
Representative Laban.
Yes.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Foster.
No.
Representative Merritt.
No.
Four yeas, five nays.
With a vote of four yeas and five nays, Amendment number 1 has failed to be adopted. Amendment number 2 is also by Representative Thompson. Representative Thompson, is there a motion?
I move amendment number 2.
There's been an objection. Will you please speak to amendment number 2?
Thank you. This is an interesting one. You have to be 21 years of age to sell tobacco. This is a little bit rough. You are going to college. You're 19 years of age. You've been working in this store, and you're a sophomore in college now, and this is paying for your college. It's the only job you can find. And now you're going to tell this person that, well, you're not going to be able to earn enough money to go to college. We're going to make it that you have to be 21 to sell cigarettes. And I feel like this is an unjust thing. There should be a way to make that happen where that a young person can get a job and make a living and make enough money to pay his way in college. So this is, I feel pretty strongly about this. This is kind of like really restricting people. Go ahead, through the chair.
Thank you, Representative Thompson. We have a question from Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess not as much a question as a statement. I think just for the committee's consideration, we've heard a lot of testimony in the last 2 months relating to labor shortages, and it was my understanding that when the federal government implemented the 21 alcohol age restriction, that those who were under 21 but 19 to 21 were grandfathered in. I think that that's definitely a fair compromise, and not just from the employee's perspective, but also from the employer's perspective of needing that workforce, that we should include this in the bill.
Thank you. Anything further from the committee? Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess this is a question for somebody. People can work in restaurants that serve alcohol that are under the age of 21. They can be, they can clear tables, they can bus tables. Even if alcohol's in the area, they can touch a glass that had alcohol in it. They can wash dishes that had alcohol in it. Now, some places that sell alcohol also have a tobacco endorsement, which means they're selling tobacco at the same business. If someone's working there that's under 21 in a kitchen capacity, can they also, and the place sells tobacco, can they stay working there if this amendment didn't pass? And I also, again, share the concerns of the amendment sponsor that if you're over 18, of all the things that were listed you can do, you can get a job, you can move out of the house, you can support yourself. If you have a job at a Quickie Mart or 7-Eleven or some kind of gas station, and that gas station sells tobacco products, does that mean at 19 you can no longer work in the gas station? You can no longer touch the actual product and make the sale. Someone else has to do it, but you can still keep your job. I guess that's a question for maybe a legal person.
Thank you. Representative Thompson?
Yes, thank you. Thank you for the question, Representative Wohl. Through the chair, this could create a new problem that was pointed out by Representative Rasmussen. You know, we've got a labor shortage. A lot of these places, like a gas station or a smaller mom-and-pop grocery store, wouldn't be able to have that person work for them because they don't have other employees. They'd have to have an extra employee just to sell cigarettes. I think this is a wrong way to look at it, and I don't like that idea of putting that much more restriction on the workforce and on people trying to earn a living or trying to pay for college.
Great, thank you. And online we have Emily Naumann from Legislative Legal. Ms. Naumann, are you available to help Representative Wohl with his question?
Yes. And I did hear the question. So through the chair, current state law at 1176-100A4 prevents a person, current law, under the age of 19 from selling cigarette, tobacco, or product containing tobacco. The bill raises that age to 21. So a person 19 years of age that currently, under the current law, can sell cigarettes, cigars, tobacco, or product containing tobacco could no longer sell those items if the bill was to pass after the effective date.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Does that mean they can't work anywhere in the same business, or they just can't actually engage in the touching of the product to a customer who then receives the product?
This is Emily Naumann for the record, Legislative Legal, through the chair to Representative Wohl. The text of the law says that it's a violation for a person under the age of 19 years of age to sell a cigarette, cigar, tobacco, or product containing tobacco. It doesn't say anything about the surrounding business or the premises.
Representative Wohl.
Yeah, I guess I thank you for that answer. And I guess I still sympathize with the plight of the amendment sponsor in that if you're 19 and currently working at a place that you are engaged in that activity, you can no longer work there. And I know New Zealand, the country of New Zealand, has instituted strict tobacco laws, but they're graduated. So each year, another cohort of people, the law changes every year. So if you're allowed to buy cigarettes right now at whatever age, 18, 19, 20, you can still buy them. And then the people behind you can't, so then the age keeps going up year after year until it hits the age of, I think, infinity. But so I don't know if that's a possible a provision or amendment to this amendment, so someone who's currently working could stay working, similar to what they did with the alcohol laws when they passed in Alaska. So the people were sort of, the people that could already drink were grandfathered in.
We will come back to that, Representative Wohl. Representative Josephson.
For the chair, for Ms. Naumann or the sponsor, do we know of any reason why the T21 st- statute or federal law would be offended or conflict with this amendment.
Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. If Joe Darnell is online, he is the tobacco compliance person from the state, and he was to be online, and I think it would be best for him to answer that.
Thank you. Mr. Darnell, thank you for being with us. Can you help Representative Josephson with his question, please?
Yes, through the chair. Could he please repeat it? I could barely hear it when he asked it.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, through the chair. Mr. Darnell, as I read this amendment, it says for one opportunity only, which seems to meet Representative Wool's conditions, although maybe I'm hearing them wrong, but essentially present 19 and 20-year-olds could continue to sell cigarettes, although they couldn't smoke them. And my question is that all right and compliant with this federal law called T21?
Through the chair, Representative, yes, that would comply with federal law that's out there if that was to pass.
And, sir, if you could please place yourself on the record.
I apologize. Joe Darnell, last name D-A-R-N-E-L-L, and I'm Chief Investigator for Underage Tobacco Enforcement for the Department of Health and Social Services.
Great. Thank you so much, Mr. Darnell. Representative Wool.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Just for clarification, and I'm sorry I didn't get what he said, but he says that if you're working in a tobacco store and you're under 21 and not smoking, obviously, because it's illegal and you can't do that at work, but simply being involved in the sale of the product, is that acceptable to T21? Is that's the organized national group? Is that what the question was? I'm sorry.
Yes, that was the question, but I don't think it's an organized national group. It's a federal law that has a shorthand descriptor, T21.
Okay, yeah. And he said this amendment would be okay if it passed. It would be in compliance with federal law. Is that correct?
Mr. Darnell?
Through the chair, yes.
Great. Thank you very much. Wow. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I just want to draw parallels again to alcohol. Not in this state, but many states allow people that are under 21 working in restaurants not only to clear the table, to actually serve alcohol to the customers. And they trust that the people selling it and doing their job are not going to be glugging sips while they're walking back and forth to serve the customers. And people over 21 don't do that also. So I think that's would be pretty fair with this. If someone's selling cigarettes at a gas station convenience store are not going to be, you know, if they're smoking, they're breaking the law anyways. But I think engaging in the sale seems, whether you're 19 or 22, it's still just buying them. Obviously, they have to card the person buying them.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the chair. I'm not sure if this is a question for legal. Would the liability to enforce non-use, I guess, for employees under the age of 21, between 19 and 21, or 19 and 20, would that fall on the employer, or would that fall on the employee if they were misusing tobacco products, the nicotine products, underage?
Ms. Nauman?
This is Emily Nauman. For the record, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal Services. I'm not sure I entirely grasp the question, but through the chair to Representative Rasmussen, the current law, 1176-100A-4, states that a person who allows a person commits the offense of selling or giving tobacco to a person under the age of 21, as the law will be amended. If the person holds a business license and allows a person under the age of 21 to sell cigarettes, cigars, tobacco, or a product containing tobacco. Does that answer your question?
No, sorry, if I could follow up through the chair. I'm trying to understand who has the liability if the person Amendment number 2 by Representative Thompson passes and we allow 19 and 20-year-olds to be grandfathered in to be able to sell nicotine products or to be employed in a place that sells nicotine products, who is liable if that 19 or 20-year-old uses nicotine products from that location? Is it the employer or is it the employee that would be violating the law? Or both, I guess.
Again, this is Emily Naum with Legislative Legal Services. Might need a little bit more information about your hypothetical, and I'm sorry, through the chair. How did, in your hypothetical, the employee get the tobacco? I mean, I think that's the question, because it's a crime to provide tobacco to a person under the age of 19 under the current law, and it's also a crime for the person under the age of 19 to possess it.
Representative Rasmussen, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess what I'm trying to understand is if the employer is going to be liable, if a 19 or 20-year-old is employed at their location and they take or somehow obtain nicotine products from their place of work, is the employer liable for that person's possession of the nicotine product?
Again, this is Emily Naum with Legislative Legal Services, through the chair to Representative Rasmussen. I don't know exactly what it would mean to provide tobacco to a person under the age of 19. Perhaps there's someone else on the line that can better answer that question. It sounds like there is.
Representative Hannon.
Madam Chair, I think Mr. Darnell, who is responsible for the enforcement of underage and places, retail places that currently might be penalized, and I think he could be able to address that.
Thank you. Mr. Darnell?
Yes, Joe Darnell. Again, through the chair, as I understand it, this touches on a couple laws out there, if I'm understanding the question properly. There's one is the possession. If they're possessing, that would be on the person that's possessing. It wouldn't be on the employer. If they got it from the store and they purchased it and I didn't shoplift it, then it would be on, as I understand it, on the employer for allowing it to be sold to them underage. And if they were using it on premise, that would fall under the smoke-free workplace law, and that would be on the employer for allowing people to smoke on the workplace. I mean, I think the question hit a whole bunch of different areas there, if I understood it correctly.
Great, thank you. That was helpful. Anything further? Representative Wool, are you interested in making an amendment to the amendment?
No.
Okay. That takes us to amendment number 2. Is the objection maintained?
It's not, but I just want to be clear on the record that my reading of this is from the effective date, one must be 19 or 20. It would be sort of the last cohort of 19 and 20-year-olds that could remain employed and sell legally tobacco. Is that
Representative Thompson.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Josephson. That is the impression that I received from the testifiers that were online. I don't want us to see a complete class of employees taken out of the labor market. So I think that he was correct in that we're covered for 19 and 20-year-olds.
Representative Thompson, this is Representative Merrick. When you say we're covered for 19 and 20-year-olds, do you mean current 19 or 20-year-olds or 19 and 20-year-olds going forward?
I was under the assumption that we're doing the same thing similar to what the alcohol tax was or serving was you're grandfathered in at this time, but it's going to still take a lot of people out of the labor market. The first-time employees, they're getting their first job in life, and I don't want to see that happen, and I think that's still going to happen as we move forward through the 19 and 20-year-olds that are presently going to be okayed and grandfathered in.
Thank you. And Tom Wright is in the room today if he would like to come forward. And He was nodding his head, but we'd like it stated on the record, please.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Tom Wright, staff to Representative Thompson. And we introduced this on behalf of another member who, you know, had a concern over this, and we thought it was a good concern. But what it does is grandfather anybody at the effective, when the state goes into, when this goes into effect, if it goes into effect, anybody who's 19 or 20 currently working in a shop or where they're selling tobacco products would be grandfathered in and would be allowed to continue their employment.
Great, thank you. Are there any further questions? Representative Josephson, and then we'll...
I withdraw my objection.
Is there further objection? I'll object for the purpose of a question. Representative Wall.
Yeah, I guess, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I support this amendment, but I think I also support, and it's not on this amendment, and maybe that's neither here nor there, but it seems like if you're 18 and working, or 19 and working in a, I guess 19, and working in a grocery store or convenience store that sells tobacco products, if this amendment passes, you can stay working there. But in 2 years, another 19-year-old couldn't do that. And I guess, based on what the person said about T21, for selling it, you're not smoking it, so you're not using the product. So I would think it would be okay. You know, you're in a convenience store, you're just selling what people want to buy, and you're not partaking in it. I don't see the harm of someone 19 selling it even if the age was 21, but I thought that's what this amendment did, but I guess it doesn't.
Are you interested in putting an amendment to amendment number 2?
Well, I don't know if it's looking around the room, but...
Brief at ease.
Yeah. Maybe we can...
House Finance back on the record. With that, we will roll amendment number 2 to the bottom of the amendment pile. So we will move on next to Representative Wool, amendment number 3. Representative Wool.
I move amendment number 3. Object.
Representative Wool.
Yeah, what amendment number 3 does is basically not make it a crime to smoke. It's not good, and you shouldn't be able to buy cigarettes, but you don't need if you're driving down the road and you're 19 or 20 in your car and you're smoking, you can get pulled over as committing a crime, and I think there's a lot of education out there about the ills of smoking. It doesn't alter your mental state like alcohol or marijuana or other things that are prohibited for people under 21. Tobacco does not do that. It's against all rules to smoke anywhere in public. We know that. It's against rules to smoke in school. There's all kinds of penalties for that. But to make it an actual crime, it seems, and I guess it is. And I know we have a gentleman on the phone that enforces that crime, and I'm just wondering how many, maybe he can answer, arrests or violations or you know, how many people have to go to court for this, because again, it's unhealthy. I don't think people should do it. I don't want my kids doing it, but do I want them going to court for it?
Mr. Darnell?
If I may, Chair Merrick, I believe Nancy Mead from the court system might be a better person. Mr. Darnell typically does enforcement with retailers, but Ms. Mead can speak to the number of violations that have occurred.
Wonderful. We love having Ms. Mead. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. As was stated, it is the DHSS, Joe Darnell, would enforce other provisions of 1176, but not the possession that is enforced by local law enforcement and state troopers. I can tell you the number of convictions we've had in the court system in the last 5 years, and it's ranged from 10 per year. This is for possession of tobacco, or then it became e-smoking products as well, by a minor. 10 some years, 64 another year, 45, 22. So it varies, but it's in that general range, a low of 10 to a high of 64 over the last 6 years.
Representative Wohl?
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Are those standalone charges, or are those in conjunction with other charges?
Through the chair to Representative Wohl, I'm afraid I don't have that data with me. Those are the number of cases in which that charge had a conviction, but I don't know if they were convicted of possession of marijuana, or I'm sorry, possession of tobacco plus assault or speeding. I don't have that.
Representative Wohl.
Thank you. So if someone's driving their dad's car and they get pulled over for a blinker or something, and there's a pack of cigarettes in the car, then that driver could be charged with possession. Is that correct?
Through the chair to Representative Wohl, that would be my understanding, yes.
Thank you. We have Representatives Josephson, Ortiz, and LeBon. Representative Josephson.
Well, I don't have any questions, but I guess under discussion.
Absolutely.
The panel, those of us that are here, declined to legalize smoking for 18, 19, 20-year-olds. This amendment would legalize smoking for 10-year-olds, as I understand it. So let's just be clear about that. You might say, well, how would a 10-year-old get tobacco? Well, they just would. And they would smoke it at a very young age, and it would become habit forming. I would say that relative to stopping somebody for smoking in a car, the typical thing to stop someone in a car is you need reasonable suspicion for a stop. And it is true that it doesn't have to be a crime. It could be a taillight. Whether it would be a cigarette, a cloud of cigarette smoke in a moving car, I don't know. That might very well be a motion to suppress and dismiss. It's unclear to me whether that would be sufficient to stop someone and then proceed to charge them with something else.
Thank you. Ms. Nauman, do you concur with Representative Josephson that this amendment would allow anyone under the age of 21 to use tobacco products? Ms. Nauman? Ms. Mead?
To the chair, to Representative Josephson, if this amendment passes, it would delete AS 1176-105, which is the offense, the violation that is for possession of tobacco by currently a minor. This would make it by someone under 21. If that were not a statute anymore, it would not be a violation for youth to possess tobacco as I read it.
Great, thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think the First Amendment we voted on was for the purchase of tobacco products. You'd still have to be 19 or 21, I guess, because that 19 amendment didn't pass. You still couldn't buy the tobacco, but if a kid was caught with it, it wouldn't be a criminal charge. And I guess I grew up in a different era when, although kids weren't encouraged to smoke and were actually discouraged to smoke, occasionally they get their hands on their parents' tobacco products and go behind the school and smoke them. It was definitely not an approved activity, but it wasn't a crime, and I guess that's the distinction. It's misbehavior of the youth, but, you know, to call it a crime. Now, should you buy it? No, you shouldn't be able to buy it. Same with alcohol. You shouldn't be able to buy it.
Thank you. Representative Ortiz.
Nothing.
Representative Lebon.
Madam Chair, I pass.
Okay. Anything further? Is the objection maintained? With that, Madam Secretary, please call the roll.
Representative Thompson.
Yes.
Representative Wolf.
Yes.
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yeah.
Representative Josephson.
Amendment 3, no.
Representative Lebon.
Yes.
Representative Ortiz.
No.
Representative Rasmussen.
Yes.
Representative Johnson. Representative Merrick.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
No.
7 yeas, 3 nays.
And with a vote of 7 yeas and 3 nays, amendment number 3 has been adopted. Next we have amendment number 4 by Representative Josephson. Representative Josephson, do you have a motion?
I move amendment 4.
I'll object for purpose of discussion. Representative Josephson.
Yes. Madam Chair, this amendment expands the definition of electronic smoking product subject to the tax to include the device, such as vape pens, sold separately from the nicotine cartridge. This policy reflects how our Alaska municipalities, such as Anchorage and many others, tax electronic smoking products. Municipalities apply the same tax to the devices as well as to the substance being aerosolized and to tobacco itself. For the state to tax only the substance being inhaled will cause extra work and confusion for businesses. Alaska needs a comprehensive definition, which this amendment provides. And all I'll say is I believe that those in Alaska that care about the health of our youth share in this concern and see youth responding with their pocketbooks. First of all, it would match the tax on tobacco, wholesale tobacco. So it's not especially punitive. It's an equalizer. But it's an important part of making the tax effective.
Thank you. Further discussion on amendment number 4. Representative Wolf.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I guess a product can be used to deliver aerosolized or vaporized nicotine. I support the tax of nicotine products like tobacco and cigars, I guess, and vape liquids and such. But I guess, and I know some of the vape pen, which is listed here, I think is also used in the marijuana industry, which I don't know if it's taxed as marijuana in that industry or not. And I just worry that if you go too broad, you know, our cigarette lighters taxed as a delivery device for tobacco, or rolling papers taxed as a tobacco product, even though they don't have nicotine in them or tobacco in them. They're just delivery devices as well. So I guess that would be my question to Ledge Legal or the bills, the amendment sponsor. I just don't want to go too broad. Certainly an e-cigarette that has nicotine and a battery that's all in one, it should be taxed as all as one, but if something's a standalone device with no nicotine or anything in it, should it also be treated like a nicotine product?
Representative Josephson.
Well, I don't know that there was a question directed at me, but this would not replace the existing tax in 4361.010 to 030, which is a separate new from 2014 excise tax on marijuana. This is, as you can see by the definition, focused on products that I understand, based on the heating mechanism, would be unique and uniquely used by e-cigarette users, typically youth, not obviously adults as well, but a lot of youth, and it would act as further deterrent toward their purchase of these products.
Thank you, Representative Wool. Would you like further clarification from Ledge Legal?
Yes, thank you. I guess on the question of rolling papers, are they taxed as a nicotine product? And the vape pen that's used in the marijuana industry, is that taxed as a marijuana product?
Thank you. Ms. Nauman?
For the record, this is Emily Nauman, Legislative Legal, through the chair to Representative Wool. This isn't wouldn't do things like lighters or rolling papers because those things aren't used for electronic smoking. Your question related to marijuana taxation is a little more complex, and I'm not totally sure of how this definition of electronic smoking product would be applied, just being unfamiliar with how electronic smoking products and marijuana interact. Perhaps there's someone else on the line that could speak more specifically to how electronic smoking products and legalized marijuana, how those things interact in the real world.
Mr. Darnell, is that a question that you're able to answer?
Through the chair, I can give a broad answer on it. When it comes to marijuana and vaping, they both use vaporizers that's similar. I do know that the heating requirement is higher for one than the other, so they're not the exact same product from a marijuana shop to a vape shop. Other than that, I couldn't go much deeper into it.
Thank you. Representative Wool.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I couldn't hear every communication that came through on either of those last calls. But I think Ms. Nauman said that rolling papers aren't taxed because they're not a nicotine product, but they are a nicotine or marijuana delivery device. I don't know. I guess you could use them for, you know, decoration or something, but I don't know. And the question of the vape pen for marijuana, is that taxed as a marijuana product? And was that answered? And does anyone know, are the vape pens taxed as a marijuana product? And I know we have someone that might be able to answer that.
Through the chair, Representative Wool, this is Stephanie Andrew for the record. In section 14 of the bill, it clearly states that the tax does not apply to an electronic smoking product that is currently taxed under the marijuana statutes. So any of the component of the solution that is taxed under the marijuana statutes is not taxed under this bill. And so the devices and other pieces are separate from that, because it's anything that does not contain, that is not currently taxed under the marijuana statute and does not contain nicotine. So the portion of the device that does not contain nicotine is also not subject to this tax. And that has also been my understanding, based on what Legislative Legal has told us in separate memos, that it is not our intention to tax marijuana products, and that as currently written with the definition that is currently in the bill, and then this new proposed amendment may change that, marijuana products that are not, that are the device or the hardware, so to speak, are not going to be captured in this tax.
Follow up?
Thank you for that explanation. So in the current bill, we're looking at, you're not taxing hardware, you're just taxing the liquid that has nicotine, the vape liquid.
And the integrated, through the chair, Representative Wool, and the integrated devices. So if it's a refillable kit or it's an integrated device in the definition of electronic smoking product, that is currently captured and is subject to the tax.
And this amendment would add more things to be taxed that aren't in your bill, from what I understand.
Representative Wool, through the chair, it does change the definition slightly, and yes.
Representative Josephson, was that a response to Representative Wool?
It's related to the exact same discussion.
Okay, we'll go to you, and then Representative Rasmussen.
The chair, to staff, on this issue of integration, and I'm not a Keurig expert, but presumably if you buy a Keurig and you have a pod that says Keurig, it will work. Other pods may not work, even though they look very similar. If for some reason we cared about prohibiting the product, we would want to capture larger than just the Keurig pod, correct?
I'll take that through the chair. Yes. And the Keurig may be a fine example, because Keurigs initially only you had to have Keurig, and now there are a billion versions of pods that will work in a Keurig machine, and that is the nature. The definition we went with was a narrow one that captured what we believe were vaping devices that had integrated nicotine components to them, and you needed that. The definition in Amendment 4 is broader than that, incorporating the idea that this technology is changing, and you might be able to buy a device today that the current version of the bill doesn't capture, but it does recharge the Keurig pods for nicotine. And I'm not saying that Keurig is now venturing into nicotine, but just continuing that example. There are two schools of thought, and I think you are following the one which is, if the goal is to implement a tax that discourages youth participation, then you want to capture the cost, and the device itself sometimes is the bigger cost.
Representative Wall.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate the analogy that my colleague just gave on the Keurig, because I think what he's saying is if you buy a Keurig brand pod, you could also get another brand pod. But I think this amendment would tax the actual coffee machine and not just the pod, pod A or pod B. And if the coffee machine was used to make lemonade or hot tea or something that had no caffeine at all, he would still want to, the amendment would still propose to tax that machine. And I guess what the bill says is if it directly integrated with the, we're using coffee and caffeine, directly integrated, it's taxable. But if you have a coffee machine that makes a really good hot cider, then it shouldn't be taxed. And so I'm going to oppose the amendment.
Thank you. We've had a request from Representative Rasmussen to have Lacey Wilcox come forward and describe the difference between a marijuana and vape device. Please put yourself on the record. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. Lacey Wilcox, president of the Alaska Marijuana Industry Association. There is an assumption that the batteries used for nicotine are different than the batteries used for cannabis, and it is not always the case. So that hopefully answers the first question. They are sometimes interchangeable. There is a concern that because it looks like a wholesale tax, when I'll use myself as an example, as a manufacturer of a cannabis vape cartridge, that where I buy my empty cartridge from could be considered the device related to a vape pen, and where I buy my batteries from, that wholesale moment, whether it's from Taiwan, from a place in Anchorage, or a place in Phoenix, that this could be accidentally captured. Understanding that the intent is not to do that, the industry would like it to be made abundantly clear that they are interchangeable in certain cases. It's not always the case, but it could happen. And it would put Alaskan vape manufacturers in a really uncomfortable place. If suddenly their supplier of batteries and empty tanks before filling them with cannabis were taxed in that moment at 75%.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the chair. Ms. Wilcox, do you think that Amendment Number 4 accomplishes the clarification that industry seeks, or is something more or different needed?
I don't think I don't think it does. I think that we were getting there with the does not when it sold separately. That kind of was getting to where our concern was. So if you're buying just a battery, then you might be okay. But again, I'm concerned now about the tank before we fill it. So in this amendment, it fixed one part, I think, a little bit, but it opened it up on the tank. That is, there's a wholesale moment. I buy flats of 1,000 at a time. I buy 1,000 batteries at a time. I do not sell them together as a unit. They're sold separately in cannabis retails. You buy the cartridge and you buy the battery. I need to ensure to the industry that both of those things are held harmless from this.
Yes, Representative Josephson.
Through the chair, just procedurally, and I did make some due diligence effort relative to Senator Stevens' bill, and I see his staff here. An amendment really close to this, there's one clause, the clause is whether or not the substance includes nicotine, that differs. But the amendment largely like this was adopted by the Senate. Did you testify before the other body?
No, I did not.
Representative Josephson.
Well, you know, I know that we have a finite amount of time and other things to do. I don't know if Mr. Lampkin, I don't want to, I have no questions. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wilcox. We appreciate you being here. Anything further?
Madam Co-Chair, if I could move to roll this amendment. So we can have a little bit of clarification in case the conceptual amendment is needed.
Thank you. Is there an objection? Hearing none, we will move amendment number 4 to the bottom. Next, amendment number 5 by Representative Josephson.
I move amendment 5.
I'll object for the purpose of discussion.
Madam Co-Chair, I'm hoping that amendment 5 is less technical, but it may not be. The bill as written seems to give a pass on taxation and perhaps usage, I'd have to look at it again, if the product is a harm reduction product. I think that that is a term used by the industry, and it's true that a true cessation, tobacco cessation product would be protected under this bill. We want, I guess generally, the conventional wisdom is we believe in Nicorette, et cetera. We want people to use those systems if they can be effective. But if you say, or if the bill says, oh, in addition, anything that's a harm reducer is really just fine, then you've undercut the intent of so much of the bill. And I think the testimony before the other body, certainly by Ms. Neenan, I was sort of the Heart or Lung Association, I was skimming through it, is that the FDA doesn't, I'll say it here, the harm reduction product is a marketing label. Madam Chair, the harm reduction product is a marketing label the FDA allows to be used if a product is not quite as harmful as regular cigarettes or chew tobacco, but these products are not classified or approved by the FDA to help people stop smoking, which would be called cessation. Now, you may say this is nuanced, but I think that we should delete the words harm reduction because they are harmful.
Representative Ortiz, then Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. For the maker of the amendment, by inserting, deleting, in quotations, or harm reduction, and putting it in parentheses and capitalizing it, explain to me what that does.
Representative Josephson?
It deletes those words. So the bill at page 3, line 3, and page 4, line 27 would no longer have the three words or harm reduction.
Follow up?
Representative Josephson? Ortiz?
But I'm probably a little dense here, but why not just say delete harm reduction rather than insert or harm reduction in parentheses?
You know, you're not dense because then I would be dense. And I asked my very able and seasoned clerk, or not clerk, sorry, aide, who's been here 20 sessions, the same question. It's just a stylistic thing that is probably in the drafting manual. It's designed to show the reader these words were there and now they're not.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and through the chair. I don't even know who we could have to answer this, but it was my understanding that this is such a new product that the FDA is a little bit behind, and I think there was a study in England that had indicated this product is used for cessation when trying to quit smoking. So I'm not sure that this amendment is necessarily accurate, although we don't have studies in the United States as it's a relatively new product for this purpose. Other countries that have been utilizing it for a longer period of time do have some scientific studies to go off of. I don't know if there's anyone who can clarify that study. Possibly.
If I may, Representative Rasmussen, through the chair, the way it's written in the bill is that it has been approved by the United States Food and Drug Administration for sale as a tobacco use cessation or harm reduction product, and that is not something that the Food and Drug Administration has approved electronic smoking products for. So it's not been approved under the FDA in this country, is my understanding.
Just to follow up,
yes,
the chair.
Up.
I think maybe then it would be more appropriate to remove that it's been approved through the FDA and still note that it is a product that can be used for cessation or medical purposes, knowing that we do have people here in the state who are using it to quit smoking.
Thank you. Representative Hannon.
Madam Chair, our current statute excludes from being taxed nicotine and tobacco products that are FDA cessation approved. So that's the reason that we're using that. The phrase harm reduction got thrown in there, and that is not a phrase that the FDA uses. And if we say, if we take that out and say it doesn't have, if we just call it a cessation or harm reduction and it's not taxed, then there's, in essence, no reason to pass the bill because we'd exclude it from our tax. Our taxation structure in statute says if the U.S. FDA has approved it as a cessation device, then you're not, the tax is not applicable. And then, so patches and gum are not taxed under our nicotine statute.
Representative Josephson.
Just one thing. I could speak longer about this, but I want the body to know that the Alaska chapter of the American Cancer Society and the Alaska chapter of the Heart and Lung Association support this amendment. They don't think that e-cigarettes are truly harm reducers. They think they're harm creators.
Thank you. Anything further regarding amendment number 5? Seeing none, I will remove my objection. Is there further objection? Representative Rasmussen has objected. Mm-hmm. With that, Madam Secretary, if you would please call the roll.
Representative Wolf.
Pass.
Representative Edgman.
Yes.
Representative Johnson.
Yes.
Representative Josephson.
Yes.
Representative Laban.
No.
Representative Ortiz.
Yes.
Representative Rasmussen.
No.
Representative Thompson. Representative Wolf.
Yes.
Representative Thompson. Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Merrick.
Yes.
7 yeas, 2 nays.
With a vote of 7 yeas and 2 nays, amendment number 5 has been adopted.
Take a brief at ease.
Brief at ease. House Finance back on the record. With that, Representative Hannon, thank you for bringing House Bill 110 before us today. We are going to have amendments postponed, and we will give members an opportunity to look through these and see if additional amendments are warranted. So thank you so much for being here. With that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record at 3:02 p.m. We will now consider House Bill 104, Motor Fuel Tax Vehicle Registration by Representative Josephson. The committee last heard this bill on May 18, 2021. Amendments were due to my office this morning at 9 a.m. and we received none. Before we consider amendments, Mr. Co-Chair, do you have a motion on the committee substitute?
Yes, Madam Co-Chair, I move that the House Finance Committee adopt committee substitute for House Bill 104, Work Draft 32-LS0444/I, dated March 4th, 2022, as our working document.
Thank you, and I'll object for the purpose of discussion. I invite my staff, Sorcha Hazelton, to the table, and she will explain the changes in version I. Thank you, Ms. Hazelton.
For the record, Sorcha Hazelton, staff to co-chair Merrick. House Bill 104, as currently written, largely does three things. It doubles the motor fuel tax, it altered electric vehicle registration and fees, and it increased the surcharge paid to the Department of Environmental Conservation, Spill Prevention, and Response Division. The draft committee substitute before members this afternoon removes those first two components. It leaves only sections 5 and 11 of the original bill relating to the SPAR surcharge and the effective date. The effective date has been updated to take effect January 1st, 2023.
Thank you. Are there questions from the committee? Representative Wolf.
Clarification. Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I think I heard you correctly, but I just want to make sure. It removed the motor fuel tax section, it removed the electric vehicle registration section, and only left the SPAR section, just so I understand that.
Through the chair, that's correct.
Thank you.
Thank you. Is there further discussion? Seeing none, I remove my objection. Is there further objection? Hearing none, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move House Bill 104, version 32-LS0444/I from committee with individual recommendations and fiscal notes forthcoming, and authorize legislative legal services to make conforming changes.
And without objection, House Bill 104 is moved from committee. With that, we'll take a brief at ease. House Finance back on the record at 3:07 p.m. Next up, we are going to hear an introduction to Senate Bill 33, Seafood Product Development Tax Credit by Senator Stevens. We appreciate you being here, Senator. If you could put yourself on the record and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Gary Stevens, District P. So this bill before you, Senate Bill 33, is a value-added tax for the fishing industry. It's a seafood product development tax credit. And it truly is an economic development policy. It's been used by the state for many years. It's a value-added investment activity, and it has occurred in the past for salmon and herring industry. The program was launched in 2003. I had the pleasure of being on the committee that launched it. It was called the Alaska Salmon Task Force. We had a lot of money from Senator Ted Stevens. We were able to really help the industry to move forward. And we passed a bill very similar at that time. The sunset had been extended a few times over the years. Unfortunately, because of COVID, we ran out of time to extend it again at the end of 2020 when it expired and was repealed. What this bill does is to restore the program, but it also broadens the scope of the tax credit to include investment incentives not only for salmon and herring, but now also for pollock, cod, and sablefish products. Essentially, it translates into a partial reimbursement for investment in machinery and hardware and infrastructure in processing these fish resources. A real advantage to the processors to get into more modern equipment to do better value-added processing and to help the fishermen in prices as well. So a very short way, I say that Senate Bill 33 is intended not only to restore and maintain, but also improve the business and marketing climate for value-added seafood processing and the economic engine it is that drives Alaska. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Are there questions for Senator Stevens? Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And I had the privilege, along with a couple members, to visit some of your fine processors in Kodiak this summer. Could you explain a little bit for the record some of the regulatory burdens, I guess, that have been placed on industry recently at the federal level, just to kind of offset some of the costs now that they're facing?
Tim, if you can address that.
For the record, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens, through the chair, Representative Rasmussen, there's been a number of changes. And first of all, this bill restores existing statute that's been on the books since 2003. Many of those credits were used by the salmon and herring industry. But as you know, with adding things such as Pacific cod and particularly pollock and now sablefish as well in this bill, would bring in some more federal considerations but that have been felt by the industry. Now, going into the details and specifics on that, but not being a commercial fisherman, we do have folks online that can speak in much more detail to that effect.
I do not see anyone online. Is there someone specific?
Brief at ease. So I text them.
I House Finance back on the record. We have with us Mr. Christopher Barrows, the president of the Pacific Seafood Processors Association. Welcome to House Finance. Did you hear Representative Rasmussen's question? Mr. Bennett Barrows, can you hear us?
Hi, yes, this is Chris Barrows. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can now. Did you hear Representative Rasmussen's question?
I think I heard part of it. Can I get it restated, though, just so I make sure that I did hear it correctly? Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you for being with us. And if you could state your name and affiliation for the record. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. My name is Chris Barrows. I'm with Pacific Seafood Processors Association. I'm calling in from Anchorage today.
Great. Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair, and through the chair. Mr. Barrows, a few of us toured some of the processing facilities in Kodiak late last year, I guess, and one of the issues that was raised was some federal regulation that was implemented, and it sounds like, I don't remember if it was tens of millions or 100 million, but there was a pretty sizable private capital investment that was required to be able to meet some of the new federal-level regulatory restrictions that were put in place. Could you speak to that at all?
I can thank you again. This is Chris Barrows with Pacific Seafood Processors Association, and through the chair. There's a number of costs that are associated with being able to operate seafood processing in Alaska, and there's environmental compliance regulations which are that we're operating in conjunction with the Clean Water Act and other environmental standards. There's some new permitting that is being applied by ADEC in terms of applying those federal regulations. I wouldn't necessarily describe them as new, but there's changes associated with that, and I don't have the numbers associated with what it's going to cost companies to come into compliance and meet some of the new standards that's outlined in the permitting. But just as a sense in terms of what the industry is dealing with, that's one of them. There's also, I think, the $100 million number that I'm familiar with is the McKinley Research estimate for the cost for processing side of the industry to address and to mitigate COVID mitigation throughout the plants. And that's just in 2021. 2020, that cost was estimated to be $70 million. And so that's a specific number, and maybe I don't know if that's the $100 million that you're referencing. But there's costs also associated with access to workforces, both bringing in people from around Alaska, from the lower 48, and then also foreign guest workers to round out the needs for processing workers. So those are three categories that I can speak to in generality in terms of associated costs that the industry is dealing with.
Thank you. Senator Stevens.
Yeah, thank you. And certainly we're concerned about those additional costs, workforce, COVID, environmental issues. But this bill does not speak to that. This bill is value added, and it gives a tax credit to the processors when they buy new equipment that will do a more value-added product that will, for example, what we've done in the past many years ago when we first did this in 2003, the processors in Bristol Bay began doing fillets instead of just canning salmon. And so higher quality product brought more money to the fishermen, helped everyone along the way. So maybe Chris could speak to that, but I'm not sure that any of the monies that they are able to get through tax credits in this bill, I don't think they could be used for those things that I've mentioned for COVID, for environmental, for workforce issues. Am I right, Chris?
Mr. Barrows?
Yes, through the chair. That there's not a direct relationship. I think that there's a good context that Representative Rasmussen brings up in terms of the total cost for industry and why this bill is so important and relative to being able to provide some of the flexibility that the companies need to be able to invest in value-added products and to provide assist with that specific aspect of it for the purposes that Senator Stevens has outlined as for the purposes of this bill. So I think it's good context, but it's not directly related. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Rasmussen.
Yes, thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I appreciate the comments from both previous speakers. I was trying to highlight that the industry already has a sizable amount of skin in the game, I guess, if you will, and you know, the need for this, I guess, in comparison for the financial impact to the state is substantially smaller than the amount of investment that the private companies are already putting in place. So thank you.
Thank you, Senator Stevens.
If I could follow up, I appreciate that, Representative Rasmussen, and I do see an area maybe for water quality where if they can send the cleaner water back into the bay, then they can make fuller use of the fish products that they are processing, all the waste, and many companies are doing that, using that waste to create dog food and fertilizer and all those sorts of things. So that could be an offshoot of this.
Great, thank you. And with that, we will go. Mr. Barrows, are you prepared for your invited testimony?
Yes, I am. Yes, I am, Madam Chairman.
Yes, well, please go ahead. Thank you for being with us.
All right, thank you. So thank you, Madam Chairman, and also thank you to members of the committee. And so, again, for the record, my name is Chris Barrows, the president of Pacific Seafood Processors Association, and I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today in support of Senate Bill 33, the Seafood Product Development Tax Credit. So just a little bit about PSPA. We were founded in 1914. We're comprised of eight major seafood processing companies from Ketchikan to Unalaska to St. Paul that operate in the center of Alaska's wild and sustainable seafood supply chain. Our members operate 25 facilities in 15 coastal communities across Alaska and three floating processors. And we purchase Alaska seafood from harvesters, process it into various product forms, and distribute it to markets in the U.S. and around the world. Very competitive markets. Senate Bill 33 is a bill that would reestablish and augment Alaska's Seafood Product Development Tax Credit Program, which expired in 2020. The bill would reestablish this longstanding program through 2026 and would expand a list of eligible species, which is currently salmon and herring, to also include, or was previously salmon and herring, excuse me, to also include wild Alaska pollock and Pacific cod. This is an important expansion for us, as wild Alaska pollock and Pacific cod comprise about 69% of Alaska's statewide harvest, which represents a lot of opportunity for obtaining more value from these high-volume species over the long term. Higher value means more value to fishermen, more value to processors, and more value to the state of Alaska's general fund and to local governments, since both local and state fish taxes are based on the value of the fish. This type of program and investment incentive can make a difference in companies being able to obtain value-added equipment that will provide benefits to Alaska for years to come. Our member companies and Alaska's wild seafood products compete in global markets and have a steady volume of annual harvest on the order of about 5.7 billion pounds. However, the volume of Alaska fisheries is not likely to change significantly over time, thus increasing the value of our seafood is key to the future growth in our sector. Increasing value requires market differentiation, research and development, and consumer awareness, details that require significant investment. This bill serves the objective of increasing seafood value by encouraging innovation in the seafood processing sector, facilitating greater utilization of each fish, as Senator Stevens just mentioned, as a possibility, and in providing incentives to respond to changing market demands. So the seafood processors have used previously authorized tax credit to make some critical investments in processing technologies that would otherwise be cost prohibitive for some processors. Salmon is the great example, as the previous tax credit has changed the face of salmon processing to increase production of fillet and other value-added salmon products that have stronger U.S. market demand. To this point, I want to call to your attention the quantitative analysis developed by McKinley Research Group. I believe it's in the document section for the bill, that describes the impacts of the tax credit in relation to salmon, directly contributing the generation of an additional $114.4 million in new revenue to the State of Alaska General Fund due to product form changes and the resulting increase in product value. A higher product value means a higher return on investment for Alaska, coastal communities, and all fisheries participants. So thanks for considering this bill. The health of the commercial seafood industry and is critical to Alaska, as it generates between $5 and $6 billion in economic value to Alaska annually, and creates more jobs than any other private industry in the state. We see this as a win-win for the state in terms of the return on investment to the sector, the seafood processing sector, as the credit facilitates additional process innovation, as well as a win for harvesters and fishing communities in the form of increases in both the prices paid for fish and the additional tax receipts paid out because of increases in value in the marketplace. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Barrows. We appreciate your testimony today. Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Thank you, Mr. Barrows, for your testimony today. And thank you, Senator Stevens, for bringing Senate Bill 33 before us. In the end, there's no doubt that this representative will be supportive of extending the tax credit. Certainly understand the value of the program. My question is, I think you mentioned earlier in your testimony how long the tax credit program has been in existence. Can you tell me again, or could you repeat that?
Mr. Lampkin?
Through the chair, Tim Lampkin, staff to Senator Stevens. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, it first came on the books in 2004 and has been, the sunset's been extended a number of times.
Okay. And then with that tax credit being in place, what percentage of the 5.7 billion pounds that are harvested annually ends up going overseas for overseas processing? Do we know that figure?
Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, well, I know that currently none of it goes to Russia or China. But beyond that, I think there's quite a significant amount that goes to other Southeast Asian countries. But with specifics, I'll defer to Mr. Barrows or others.
Mr. Barrows?
Thank you, through the chair. So what percentage of harvest goes to additional companies? I believe that ASME has a great deal of data associated with that. So I would refer to Jeremy Woodrow. I'm not sure if he's online. I know he was intending to be online, but I think that's a great ASME question. Mr. Ortiz.
Yes, we do have Mr. Woodrow with us. Mr. Woodrow, if you could place yourself on the record and help Representative Ortiz with his question. Thank you for being with us.
Yes, for the record, Jeremy Woodrow, Executive Director, Alaska Seafood Marketing Institutes. Through the chair, Representative Ortiz, in any given year, anywhere from 70 to 75% of value of our product is sent overseas. I'm trying to pull up a report right now. I believe, are you looking for gross weight that's sent overseas, Representative?
I think your per the value figure works for me. That's fine. So 70-75% of the seafood harvested value is exported overseas for processing, or is exported for direct purchase consumption?
For the chair, Representative, it's for both. A good portion of that is for secondary processing. What happens in markets, that's you're really up to the buyer. So it could be further processed, even if it's left Alaska in what we consider a final form.
Representative Ortiz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And again, I'm very supportive of the program. We'll continue to be. My question is, since that program has been in existence in 2004, have we been able to cut into that percentage of overseas processing at all, or is that percentage gradually gone up over the years, despite our efforts to incentivize processing here in our waters or in our lands?
Through the chair, Rep. Ortiz, that's a difficult one to answer because we have increased our exports and the value of our exports over the last couple decades, and that's been intentional given that Alaska seafood and seafood in general is a highly traded global commodity. I think it would be difficult to say that we've kept seafood here in Alaska, though we've been able to increase the value of our seafood here in the States. And, you know, I know Chris Barrows pointed to the McKinley research reports that should be in your packet that points to this salmon tax, or that the tax credit that was mainly used for salmon products has increased the value of those salmon products in the last couple decades since the tax was put in place. And so I think that's an easier one to point out, that that has increased the value, at least here in Alaska, for those products.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Mr. Woodrow, can you tell us, you were going to say the percentage of weight that was shipped overseas for processing, and you gave the value. What is the weight? I'm just curious, the weight-to-value ratio that's shipped overseas.
Through the chair, Representative Wohl, if you give me a second, I'm trying to, my fingers aren't as moving as fast as my mouth. Let's see if we can get that back to you. If we don't get back to you this hearing, we'll definitely provide it back to the committee in writing.
Thank you. Representative Wohl has had that problem as well.
Follow up, please, Madam Co-Chair.
Yes, follow up, Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. And just so I understand, I was part of a group that took a tour of some Kodiak fish processors, and different facilities did different levels of processing. One of them did very rudimentary and then shipped blocks of frozen fish overseas to be further processed. And I think the obvious economy of scale was present that wouldn't be present in Alaska, so the buyer could or seller could sell a lot of their fish overseas with minimum processing. But every bit of processing adds value, I imagine. So when we're talking about a tax credit for value adding, I'm just curious how that is measured, to what degree of processing. I think any degree adds value. So the more we do here, the more value it has when we send it to wherever. Can you maybe elaborate on that a little bit? As a layman, a non-fish industry person, as far as this bill is concerned, what's considered value added? You know, heading and gutting a fish technically adds value, but that's not what we're talking about here, I assume. So maybe you can elaborate on that a little bit.
Mr. Barrows, if you could place yourself on mute, please. Thank you so much. Mr. Woodrow?
Yes, through the chair, Representative Wohl, you're exactly right that any time that we pull a fish out of water here in Alaska and further process it, whether that is headed and gutted or beyond that form, you are adding value to that fish because you're removing effort down the supply chain that someone else would have to put in place. Typically, I think an easier way to look at adding value, you know, canning salmon would be adding value to that species because that's a final product form. If you look at just the way salmon has used this tax credits, the fillet form leaving the state has been a very popular addition to the products leaving the state instead of just headed and gutted. And fillet often is used as a final product form, whether that's sold in retail or used by chefs, because that's one less effort that they have to put in place in a restaurant when they have that pin boned removed as well as final fillet form. So that's one way it's used. I know that some processors are also looking at, you know, smoking their products. That would be another a form of a final value products. Another thing that we're seeing down the supply chain as far as adding value is we're seeing more convenience products that can be used in a retail sector. Whether that's put in where you have flavors added to that final product so it can be removed from the packaging and cooked at home without having to do anything else other than eat and serve. That's another product form that we're seeing adding value to our product. So really the options are limitless when you add that value.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Mr. Woodrow, if you're prepared with your invited testimony.
Bring it up. One second. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the House Finance Committee. The Alaska Seafood Market Institute supports all efforts that will help increase the value of Alaska's fisheries. SB 33 will provide the Alaska seafood industry incentive and support to continue much-needed investments in processing facilities and take additional measures to create more value for key Alaska seafood species. Alaska's commercial fisheries annually harvest on average 5.7 billion pounds of seafood. After processing, approximately 2.8 billion pounds of seafood is produced and sold to markets worldwide. This leaves roughly 3 billion pounds of potential product and opportunity to add even more value to Alaska's seafood resources. Products such as fish and bone meal and fish oil currently generate hundreds of millions of dollars annually for Alaska's seafood industry. Additional growth is forecasted in pet foods, nutraceuticals, medical advancements, food preservation, and more. This will all be produced from byproducts such as fish skin and heads, crab shells, and similar often discarded items. Any effort made to help maximize our sustainable seafood resources will benefit the state. Prior to the COVID-19 pandemic, Alaska's major shoreside seafood processors invested over $100 million annually in capital expenditures. Processors' investment and multiplier impacts are closely tied to the resource value. Expanding value provides processing companies capital to modernize their plants, expand production lines, and pay higher fish prices. All of these benefit local communities in Alaska and provide growth elsewhere in the U.S. economy. The last 2 years have been extremely difficult for the Alaska seafood industry, and in turn, Alaska has seen its export values decline considerably over the course of the pandemic. Shipping disruptions and escalating costs, border closures, continued high tariffs in key export markets, and rolling closures of end markets have led to lower value of Alaska's commercially harvested seafood. When compared to 2019, exports in 2020 were down $500 million and down approximately $300 million in 2021. Furthermore, Alaska lags considerably behind foreign seafood competitors when it comes to the modernization of its seafood industry. Other seafood-producing nations from Norway to Chile have invested heavily in updating their automation, computerization, and efficiency of their seafood processing plants. Without incentives and or other financial support, Alaska will continue to fall further behind, which will negatively impact the opportunity to maximize the value of our seafood. Lastly, ASME market research shows that consumers worldwide are increasingly seeking convenient, easy-to-prepare products that match their busy lifestyles. Consumers are no longer want to sacrifice health, flavor, and quality when choosing convenience-based products. This trend creates tremendous opportunity for Alaska seafood producers to capitalize on by producing new, innovative, and value-added seafood products. SB 33 supports this trend and will help Alaska seafood companies develop products to match consumer demand. Thank you, Chair Merrick, and members of the House Finance Committee for recognizing the opportunity to add value to the Alaska fisheries and Alaska's economy. I'm available to answer any more questions should there be any.
Great. Thank you very much. Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. I have two questions, whether for the bill sponsor or any of our invited guests. And forgive me for my ignorance, but which tax exactly are we giving credit to for? And secondly, if a processor buys a machine such as a pin bone remover, for example, to add value, and then later that machine needs replacement, would that credit be repeated for a repeat purchase of the same equipment, adding value again, even though it's not adding to the additional value? It's replacing the added value that was already added, if that makes sense.
Thank you. Mr. Lamkin?
Tim Lamkin, Staff Senator Stevens, through the chair, Representative Wohl. So not being an accountant, but I understand that this hardware, this equipment is depreciated over time, and so that when such an asset is released, it's no longer subject to be applied for the tax credit. And if in a new investment that adds that value to that product, I would expect that it would be applicable for use for the credit. However, I would like Department of Revenue to clarify that, since they're the ones that are dealing intimately with these credits.
That was my next suggestion. We have Nicole Reynolds, the Deputy Director of the Tax Division with the Department of Revenue. Good afternoon, Ms. Reynolds. Would you be able to help Representative Wohl with his question?
Hi, good afternoon. Through the chair, my name is Nicole Reynolds. I'm the Deputy Director of the Tax Division at the Department of Revenue. To address the first question, what tax does this credit apply to? It's the fisheries business tax, and the credit is taken against the state's share of that tax. So the fisheries business tax is split 50-50 between the state and the local communities, and so the credit applies to the state's share of that 50%. In regards to the question about if a piece of equipment qualifies for the credit and then later that piece of equipment needs to be replaced, the language of the bill says qualified investment and new property first placed into service in a shore-based plant or on a vessel. And let's see here. Sorry, I'm just looking at some notes here. The bill says it does not include the overhaul, retooling, or modification of new or existing property. But if it's a complete replacement of property, if it's a new piece of equipment to replace existing property, then it would theoretically qualify for that credit.
Thank you. And Ms. Reynolds, while we have you, if you would review the fiscal note for us, it's control code S.
Sure.
LWKY.
Sure. Through the chair, so the department submitted an updated fiscal note back in February, and the update is for the committee substitute version N that we're talking about. We also updated it for the updated information in the fall 2021 revenue forecast. And then the update also includes the specific species of cod that would fall under the credit, which would be Pacific cod and sablefish. Those species are defined in the bill version. So based on that, the Department of Revenue estimated that in fiscal year 2023, the credit would be negative $1.6 million. This represents one half of a tax year of revenue impact. If companies make significant new investments later in calendar year 2022, the revenue impact could be higher as the credit earned in the second half of calendar year 2022 could be used to offset up to one half of the entire calendar year 2022 fisheries business tax liability. The revenue estimates for fiscal year 2024 through 2027 range between negative $3.0 million and $3.6 million. And then we have a fiscal impact for fiscal year 2028, which is estimated to be negative $2.7 million. And this fiscal impact reflects the assumption that some credits will be carried forward as credits can be carried forward for 3 years under the new provision AS 4375037D. As far as where the revenue would be deposited, it would be deposited into the general fund, and there would be no cost to the department to implement this credit, since we've already been implementing it. We would just need to update some of our forms and our tax management program, but we would absorb those costs in-house.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Reynolds. We appreciate you being here. We have a question from Representative Wohl.
Thank you, Madam Co-Chair. Ms. Reynolds, what is the total tax that's received by the state, less the credit? Obviously, the last few years, the credit sunsetted, but what's the total state share of the fisheries business tax?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Wohl, I'm looking at our annual report, and our total tax collections for fiscal year 2018 through 2021 ranged from 46.2 million to 34.6 million. The amount of money that was shared with the municipalities over that time frame was, in fiscal year 2018, we shared 23.7 million. The state kept 21.2 million. And then in 2019, we shared 23.6 million with the municipalities. The state kept 21.2 million. In fiscal year 2020, the state shared 19.4 million and the state kept 24.1 million. In fiscal year 2021, the state shared 24.8 million and the state kept 13.8 million.
Representative Wohl. Great, thank you. Thank you so much, Ms. Reynolds. We appreciate it. And finally, we have two invited testimony folks left. Julianne Curry, Public Affairs Manager at Icicle Seafoods. Welcome to House Finance. If you could state your name, affiliation, and please begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. How's my sound today?
It sounds great. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, committee members. My name is Julianne Curry, Public Affairs Manager for Icicle Seafoods and a lifelong Alaskan. Icicle has over 55 years of processing history in Alaska, and we're here to proudly support SB 33, the Seafood Product Development Tax Credit. We have provided a letter of support for the record. We were ecstatic to see that this bill was going to include pollock and cod as eligible species under this longstanding and important program. This bill would be a game changer for Alaska processors. Creating higher valued seafood products is one of the primary ways to increase the dockside price of fish for harvesters and create stability for the processing workforce by producing additional product forms made from sustainable seafood harvested in Alaska. SB 33 would allow for the purchase of equipment to not only increase the quality of seafood produced, but would also incentivize more value-added product forms that would help revolutionize processing platforms in Alaska. This bill will also vastly improve the ability to further capture the waste stream and turn this underutilized resource into a valuable Alaska product. In an industry with razor-thin margins, SB 33 would give the industry the advantage needed to effectively compete in the domestic and global marketplace. The timing couldn't be more perfect. The COVID-19 pandemic has brought many challenges to the seafood industry, including drastically increased operating costs. Processors work hard to streamline operations since the pandemic began, but the impacts of these costs have been felt throughout every company and the entire industry. Although domestic and global seafood retail sales hit all-time highs during the early part of the pandemic, those sales weren't enough to offset the staggering decrease in restaurant and other food service sales, and they haven't been enough to overcome the severe disruption in the supply chain. Although SB 33 is beneficial even in non-pandemic times, we were even more supportive of this vital legislation given the current pandemic-related challenges still facing the industry. Seafood is Alaska's only major renewable resource in the industry. Processors and harvesters continuously face uncertainty such as fluctuating resource levels, as well as domestic and international market conditions, and issues related to the supply chain. This bill is one way to help create stability for our industry and bring more value to harvesters. To add to a question that's been asked today, it's worth noting that value-added equipment for the seafood industry is typically a long-term investment. Those are purchases that tend to have decades of useful life. We would like to thank Senator Stevens for introducing this legislation and helping create this opportunity for Alaska's seafood industry. This bill will have lasting impacts for processors, harvesters, and the state. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Curry. We appreciate you being with us and for your patience today. Our final testifier is Tracy Welch, the Executive Director of United Fishermen of Alaska. Ms. Welch, welcome to House Finance. If you could put yourself on the record and please begin your testimony.
Thank you. How am I coming across today?
Sounds great. Thank you.
Perfect. Thank you. Madam Chair, Co-Chair, members of the committee, thank you for scheduling today's hearing and thank you for the opportunity to testify. For the record, my name is Tracy Welch and I'm here today representing the United Fishermen of Alaska. UFA is the statewide commercial fishing trade association representing 37 commercial fishing organizations participating in fisheries throughout the state and federal fisheries off Alaska's coast. UFA strongly supports the passage of Senate Bill 33. SB 33 would reauthorize the longstanding Alaska Seafood Product Development Tax Credit and would expand the list of eligible species to include pollock and cod alongside salmon and herring. The program incentivizes value-added product development through extending a tax credit to processors who invest in qualifying processing equipment. Product development and investment in equipment can be risky for companies, but it's necessary in order for the Alaska seafood industry to remain competitive and relevant in today's market. Without the tax credit, investments in new and innovative processing equipment might have been cost prohibitive for some processors. Providing seafood processors with an avenue to recover some of their capital investment costs in exchange for investing in new equipment that produces value-added products is a win across the board. When processors are able to get more value out of each fish, the state of Alaska, processors, fishermen, and our communities benefit as well. The Alaska Seafood Product Development Tax Credit has proven effective in incentivizing new product development and allowing processors to respond to market changes and consumer demand. It is estimated that between 2004 and 2019, an additional $114.4 million in new revenue was generated for the state of Alaska due to product form changes and the resulting increase in product value. One of the takeaways from the past few years is that the seafood industry needs to be able to pivot quickly, and this program is one tool to aid in that process. As mentioned before, Senate Bill 33 would incentivize the production of value-added products and maximize the value out of each fish harvested here in the state of Alaska. We've seen great success with this in the salmon industry, and we can see the potential to do so in other fisheries. Without the Alaska Seafood Product Development Credit, the world may never have experienced products like candied salmon ice cream and the yummy chummy dog treat. So on behalf of UFA and my three boxers who supervise operations on the fishing vessel Dream Chaser and happen to love yummy chummies, please consider supporting Senate Bill 33.
Thank you so much, Mr. Welch. We have a question from Representative LeBon.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and maybe the bill sponsor or his staff would be able to answer this, or representative from the tax division. Tax credits can be spread out over any number of years at the pleasure of the taxpayer, or is there a formula that defines taking advantage of those tax credits to reflect the investment in the equipment? Or just wondering, does it need to be used sooner or later, or is there a formula that applies to these tax credits?
Thank you. Ms. Reynolds?
Through the chair, thank you for that question. Nicole Reynolds, for the record, Deputy Director of the Tax Division. The credit is limited to 50% of the value of the equipment, and then it can only be applied to 50% of a taxpayer's fish business tax liability. And then lastly, the credit can only be carried forward for 3 years. So those are the guidelines for use of the credit and how it gets applied to the tax.
Great. Thank you very much, Ms. Reynolds. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and set an amendment deadline for Monday, March 14th at noon for amendments to Senate Bill 33. Senator Stevens, any closing comments?
Well, just briefly, I know you don't have too much time here, but I will say that realize that this is only for, this is really Alaska-centric. It's equipment that has to be used here in Alaska. It can't be shipped out of state. I think when I think of some of my travels and going to various countries and seeing what is being done in other countries with value-added processing, I'm just really amazed. I was in Chile, and they do a tremendous amount of smoked salmon. No reason why that couldn't be done here in Alaska. And what they do is they take the whole fish and they smoke it, they turn it into those nice little slices you see in the grocery stores, and it turns into a tremendous value. And the other thing I'll mention, when I was in Portugal, a community of Porto, they take Alaska pollock and turn it into McDonald's, like little, you know, squares, and they cut it and bread it, and those are things that can be done here in Alaska as well, too. So that's the goal here. These value-added processes could be done here in Alaska just as well as elsewhere.
Great. Thank you. We love our Alaska seafood. Okay. And again, a reminder, Monday, March 14th at noon, amendments will be due to my office for Senate Bill 33. I would like just to mention that Representative Speaker Stutz has the companion bill, House Bill 188, and it's also in this committee, but we are hearing Senate Bill 33. So with that, our agenda has concluded for this afternoon. Our next meeting is tomorrow morning. We will hear introductions of House Bill 229, Alaska Higher Education Investment Fund, and Senate Bill 9, Alcoholic Beverage Control. And with that, we are adjourned at 3:52 p.m. Thank you.